My name is Mike Elgin, and this is my Food and Technology Podcast number 21. My guest this week is food futurist Mike Lee. Here comes the FatCast. In the future, will we all eat crickets, algae, and burgers grown in a lab? I asked the founder of Studio Industries at the recent Rethink Food Conference in Napa, California. Later in the podcast, I'll take you inside a San Francisco startup inventing the future of smart glasses. But first, here's my conversation with Mike Lee. Thanks again, Mike Lee. I really appreciate it. So let's start with what you're primarily involved in. What is Studio Industries?
Studio Industries is a food design agency. We work with food companies to ideate and develop new food products.
Fantastic. And now you have something you've been doing for a while called the Studio Feast Underground Supper Club.
Yeah.
That sounds like something I'd like to belong to. Unfortunately, I don't live in Brooklyn. But what is the Studio Feast Underground Supper Club?
So that was one of our first projects that I got involved in food with about 10 years ago. We do underground dining events. We do pop-up dinners. And, you know, it's something in between going to your friend's house in terms of the communal aspect of it and going to a fine dining restaurant in terms of the quality of food and the execution. For us, it's a creative platform. It's a model that is neither restaurant nor, anything else. And so we have a lot of creativity with what we can do and experiment with new ideas.
We talk a lot about, you certainly talk a lot about it. I write a lot about the future of food. Food, of course, is a multifaceted world. It involves agriculture, involves biotechnology, it involves restaurants, it involves all these different things. You are, among other things, working to disrupt the grocery store with something you call the future market. What is the future market idea?
The future market is really looking at just where we might be in terms of our food system in the next 50 years. But communicating that through things that you might see in a grocery store. So, not all of it is completely suggesting that disruption of the supermarket. It's suggesting the evolution of it. The supermarket is interesting because it's sort of where all these heady food issues and all these issues around consumer behavior and needs and wants, it all crystallizes there. That's where supply meets demand. And so for us, that's really interesting because anyone can wrap their heads around a food product. And if you tell a story about that food product, people have something to relate it to versus then, not everyone can relate to a policy decision, but you can relate to a food that you purchased and you ate that came out of a policy decision, shifting. And so that's why we really focus on the idea of this metaphor of a market as the place to communicate food issues and change.
Do we can we really expect that 20 years from now, 30, 40 years from now, we'll still have grocery stores? I mean, won't we get all of our groceries delivered from Amazon via drone or something like that? Will people still go to a physical place?
It's conceivable that a lot of these just-in-time solutions will happen, but I don't think the grocery store or some form of it will disappear. I think you saw a similar kind of trend around, when Netflix came to be really popular. People were all saying, oh, this is the end of the movie theater. I don't think so, because people still want that social connection and they want that place to have an experience. I think the grocery stores that will thrive in the future will be able to create experiences, and the ones that won't will still just be distributing goods, sort of dumbly, because all that other stuff, I live in New York City. I can get just about any grocery I need within an hour delivered to my apartment, right? So I have all my basic needs taken care of, but I still want to go out and see markets because I want to interact with food. I want to feel with food. I want to do something with my wife, with my friends. So in that respect, that's, I think, where I think a lot of the grocery model has to evolve.
New York City is, I think, unique in the United States in that you can get anything delivered. As you said, you can just walk out in front of your apartment, grab a transportation. People will come and take your dog for a walk. There's lots of things. So to a certain extent, what we're trying to do here in San Francisco and here in the Bay Area is recreate what New Yorkers have had for a long time, which is sort of these instant services and so on. But again, as you point out, I mean, New York City has some amazing grocery stores as well.
Yeah.
Even though you can get things delivered.
I think the real challenge, honestly, and it makes totally sense to start a grocery delivery company in a city as dense as New York City, because you can sell $1 million worth of groceries with one delivery guy. But you know, I grew up in suburban Michigan, and it's a little bit of, it's a lot of a different, it's a very different context out there. And I don't know how you make that more economically feasible when, you know, you have to drive 2 hours to drop off a couple $100 worth of groceries, you know? So that's a challenge.
We're at the Rethink Food Conference, which has been fascinating. Some great speakers here, among them was you. And you mentioned something that kind of fascinated me. You were talking about possibilities for the future of grocery stores that could include grocery stores becoming so good for providing experiences that they could replace a movie theater. People might go to a grocery store for an evening out, I assume you're was what you're getting at. You also mentioned the possibility of some farming actually taking place at the grocery store, at the site. Can you talk about some of those possibilities? Like what's the best case scenario for what a grocery store actually could become?
I think you're already seeing sprinkles of it right now, honestly, and this is why I feel I have conviction about this trend in the future, because I'm already seeing it happen. You know, so on the growing side, you know, the Whole Foods near me has a 20,000 square foot rooftop garden where they you know, a company called Gotham Greens is growing a lot of produce that's delicious. So that's already happening, and there's many other sites like that. So you know, talk about local, you know, the lettuce was literally grown 40 feet above your head in the produce department of that Whole Foods, right? On the other side, you know, especially you see food markets becoming social centers, right? Any trip to the Union Square Farmers Market at noon on a Saturday, mm-hmm. It's impossible to walk through there. Yeah. It's so crowded.
It's a great market.
It's a great market, and there's so many like that all over the place. It's a thing to do. It's a social center. It's entertainment. There's a lot of indoor food halls that are opening up. I mentioned one project that has gotten so much press, Anthony Bourdain's upcoming food market that's going to be on Pier 54 in New York City. And look, it used to be that people went out for dinner and a movie, and I think people are just going out to dinner now. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these food halls, they're really exciting, and they're where people want to go and hang out and socialize and congregate. So in that sense, you know, I don't think it's not literally a movie theater, but I think people are going to see food markets, not the grocery stores as they exist today, but food markets, centers of food, as places for entertainment, and they're going to go towards that.
I can totally relate to that. I personally drove all the way to Austin once to see the Whole Foods, the flagship store there, and it was totally worth it. And of course, one of the benefits of growing produce on the roof is that the transportation involves just dropping through a hole in the roof, and it's in the produce department.
Yeah.
Pretty fast. Your product essentially is ideas at Studio Industries. You come up with ideas. How do you monetize those ideas? What is the business, I guess, behind Studio Industries?
We're a consultancy. You know, we simply we engage with companies, and it's a pretty traditional model, like any other agency that kind of deals in, you know, intelligence and insights. Mm-hmm. And you know, we really, I think, differentiate ourselves because we're just really good cross-pollinators of ideas, and we always just are good citizens of the world, and we absorb so much culture and different mm-hmm. ideas and technology and things like that. And I think for us, we really get excited to synthesize those into new ideas. I think new ideas come from connections, and because we just do such a great job being kind of social hounds, you know, it helps us sell really interesting ideas that are really just in touch with people. Yeah.
Well, now we're talking, I've heard a lot of people speaking at this conference, and a lot of brilliant minds doing fascinating things. But I really wanted to talk to you because I feel like so many of your ideas were rooted in the reality of real problems, and you come at it from the real solution. So in a nutshell, you see, one of the big problems is we have this industrialized monoculture, which is essentially unsustainable and problematic in a whole bunch of ways that the public doesn't quite appreciate it as well as it should. And then your solution tends to be like, how do we create demand for the things that lead to the right kind of agriculture? You know, just let me give you an example of what I would consider not a bad idea, but it's a thought that occurred to me. And I'm coming around to some of the more advanced high-tech food creation. There's all these companies For example, that company that makes Just Mayo, I think it's called.
Hampton Creek.
Now, this is a super high-tech company that makes super high-tech food. And I watched the guy, the chief scientist or whatever his name was, and he explained all the scientific and technological hoops they jumped through to recreate scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, just have scrambled eggs. I mean, it's like that's so, you know, I don't know that there's a lot of problems with the poultry industry and with the egg manufacturing industry. There are lots of problems, but I don't see that eggs are the problem. Now, in your case, I really like the elegance of how you think in terms of the problem. So this monoculture idea, let's start with a bit of education about what is monoculture and why is monoculture agriculture, which sounds efficient.
Yeah.
Why is that problematic?
It's very efficient, and it was designed to be that efficient. It's problematic because it really relies on a lot of inputs. It relies on things like fertilizers, things like pesticides, because when you have a system that only has a lot of one thing, it becomes more susceptible to, you know, one weak point, right? Yeah. So all you need is to get the right pest in there, and if you're not properly protected on it, your loss is not a small portion of your crop, it's a loss of all of it, you know? Also, just, you know, when you have a hammer, every problem, every solution looks like a nail, you know? And so I think there are so many species of plants and animals out there in the world, and we don't tap into any of it. 75% of the world's food comes from 12 plant species and 5 animal species, you know. So we've put, we're very sensitive to challenges in the food system.
Yeah. And so, okay, so that's one of the challenges that people like you who want to fix the monoculture problem have, is that there are lots of companies making lots of money on monoculture. Monsanto, for example, lots of, you know, and these industries have consolidated down to, I think we're approaching 3 companies that provide 80% of this kind of, you know, of all this stuff, because monoculture is like pulling a thread out of a sweater. Well, you can have hundreds of acres of one crop of corn. Okay, so in order to do that, you can have pests. So you need pesticide. But the pesticide harms the plants because it's so strong. So we need a GMO corn that will withstand the pesticide. And then there's herb problem. And then, you know, you go down this thing and you keep trying to solve these problems that were solved long ago by crop rotation and other traditional agricultural things. So that's the problem. Monoculture is the problem. The solution is to not do monoculture. Give me one of your concept food products. Now, this is not a real product you can buy. This is an idea of a product that should exist, or it's an idea for a direction for developing food products that would create demand for non-monoculture agriculture.
One example of a product is the Three Sisters. Three Sisters is an instant polenta product. And Three Sisters refers to corn, beans, and squash, which the native Aztecs have been planting as companion planting for thousands of years. And basically what that means, companion planting, is you plant all three crops on the same site together. The corn stalk rises up and the beans climb up the corn stalk and uses that as a trellis. The squash stays near the ground layer, and the leaves, the broad leaves, help shade the soil, which keeps moisture in and keeps it cool, and also the little spikes on the veins of the squash help deter pests. So, you know, and the beans provide nitrogen for the corn, which is a very nitrogen-hungry plant. Mm-hmm. So it's this really beautiful symbiotic trio of plants, but nobody really plants this in any sort of meaningful scale anymore. It's sort of relegated to people's backyard home gardens and things like that. So for me, I could preach all day about the value of that those set of plants, but I think to really enact change to the industry that is so rooted in something else, I'd rather just like create a really big demand for this, right? So like the question for us is like, what if Three Sisters Polenta was just as big as Cheerios cereal in terms of brand value, right? Mm-hmm. Then you'd find somebody who has a lot of farmland saying, let's figure out how to do this, because there's a few billion dollars that we can make out of this. I think in most cases, big food companies are agnostic to what they want to make. They are really just out to seek profit and growth. And if you can realign where the source of that profit and growth come from, mm-hmm. and make that reinforce better agriculture, I think that's a way to enact a lot of change.
Yeah. Now, I write a lot about the future, and in a Silicon Valley mindset, the future means 3 years from now, five yeah. years from now. You tell you like to think about things 50 years from now. And you recently held an organized a future of protein dinner.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what the future of protein dinner was all about?
Yeah. Future of protein was looking at issues in protein from production and consumption, and looking at it on a multi-time scale. So we actually had a 7-course meal, and each course was designed around the zeitgeist of protein in a different era. And sort of counterintuitively to a future of dinner, we started in the past. We started in the post-industrial revolution, where bison roamed everywhere, and you know, meat was just wild and free and natural and GMO, non-GMO.
It was organic and free range,
right? By default. It wasn't a thing. It was just what it was. So, you know, that was kind of just an interesting way to ground people mm-hmm. into where we started as a society, in America at least. Mm-hmm. And paradoxically, that vision of this 1850s bison is sort of where a lot of this conversation is trying to head back to. We're trying to find that again, you know? And then we went all the way deep into, 2040, where we feel like by then, you know, things like insect protein aren't going to be mm-hmm. such a big talking point anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be kind of gracefully intertwined into our food. So we did a dish of pasta, tomato sauce, and bread, which was all made with insect flour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we chose that dish specifically because it's sort of boring and approachable. And yep. we wanted to do that on purpose because we wanted to say, look, everyone's kind of has this fear factor moment about eating insects right mm-hmm. now. And they think, oh, you know, it's going to be crawling all over my plate. But, you know, we would like to look at when trends today become boring in the future, because I think that's when yeah. when something becomes boring and expected, it's permeated
the
culture. It's mainstream. Yeah. And then 2065, we looked at, you know, how do we look at things like algae and sea plants and stuff like mm-hmm. that as sources of protein.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was the dinner, and we do these dinners on all different kinds of themes, or we plan to do them all different kinds of themes, because we want to bring big food systems issues down to a human scale.
Yeah.
It's one thing to talk about, you know, massive farming issues and sort of understand it on an academic level, but it's another thing to communicate that on a plate of food that you're literally eating right there.
Yeah. So. Now, some of the technological innovation in Silicon Valley around food makes food better. So one of my previous podcasts was about Zoom Pizza in mm-hmm. Mountain View, which has trucks where they bake the pizza in the truck. And it's like a fresher pizza. They don't need certain types of ingredients because the pizza is inherently fresh and ready to go. There's other types like the FarmBot. I interviewed the guy behind the open source FarmBot project. And this is a robot that pulls weeds. You don't need herbicides. The food's better because this has no herbicides on it. But it also, you solve the problem of weeds through this robot. It also does the planting, it conserves water, does all these great things. Fantastic. And then there's another kind of agriculture where they actually transform the food into something else in order to make it a better product or to make it more environmentally friendly. And one of the themes of this is cellular agriculture, which is there was a talk yesterday about cellular agriculture. And this is the idea where you take cells, say from cow muscle protein, or you take cells from milk, or you take cells from egg whites,
right.
and you reproduce it in a vat.
Right.
And you're essentially growing meat in a lab rather than in a cow,
right?
And you use far less water, far less land, far less money, far less everything. What is your view about the role of cellular agriculture in the future of food?
Yeah, I think I'm very bullish on that idea. I want it to succeed. It's a very early technology, so I want to be careful because I think a lot of people tend to overplay its value in the current present time. It's not ready for prime time yet, and that's fine. That's how most technologies start out. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think in the future, you know, I'm very allergic to kind of statements that sometimes people say about, you know, this one thing is going to be the future of food, mm-hmm. as if there's only one thing we'll all do, right? Yeah. And I think cellular agriculture, while I think it will be a part of the future of food, I don't think it's going to replace conventional farming. I think conventional farming, when done right, you know, animals aren't just sources of meat. They aerate the ground, they step on grass, they flatten weeds, they trim grass, you know, so there's like much more value to a cow that's pasture raised mm-hmm. than just a source of meat, you know? And I think that's important in a polyculture. But if we could knock out every CAFO farm that's making beef with a cellular agriculture mm-hmm. plant, I think that's a win. I think that's huge, but we'll also have conventional farming too.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, somebody yesterday, one of the cellular agriculture entrepreneurs yesterday made a really interesting point, which is that when you talk about cellular agriculture, people think, oh, my steak dinner or my food will be cellular. He's like, that's probably not the case. Essentially, a lot of food products are just added as an ingredient to packaged foods that are already radically industrialized, you know, box of crackers or Twinkies or whatever. Those types of products, if they had cellular dairy or they had cellular yeah. agriculture products, what's the difference? It's already incredibly sort of disintegrated yeah. food in terms of what it is already.
I think this touches on a more general conversation about just the public's overall knowledge around science, because food is a very irrational thing for people. You know, so Perfect Day, which makes synthetic milk from fermentation, that for some people maybe has a really weird perception and they think it's, oh, it's fake and it's weird, but you know, it shares a lot of the same processes as the fermentation of wine or beer, right? Mm-hmm. So where do people draw the line, mm-hmm. right? It's really tough. But I hope that as we get further along, we get more enlightened about this, and it's okay if people disagree with it, but I think I hope that they just understand it for what it is mm-hmm. and not just completely immediately demonize it, because I think it's hard when you shut out ideas because you have a blanket litmus test about something, yeah. you know? That worries me about the future, but I hope that with better education around science and technology, we become more informed citizens and we become more critical thinkers, mm-hmm. honestly. Because there's a lot of just the sky is falling kind of media and headlines that are out there.
Yeah. And I think we very well could reach a sort of best case scenario with a lot of the food technology we hear about and talk about. For example, milk is a great example. So I think that the future of sensor-based containers will enable us to actually move beyond pasteurization for people who want a better, the highest quality milk would be a raw milk.
Yeah.
But if the container could tell you whether it was safe or not, then yeah. there would be no reason to pasteurize it.
Yeah.
That would still be an expensive product for people who are pretty discerning about their diet, which is fine. But you could have a very healthy cows in a very pristine environment producing raw milk that you would be guaranteed to be safe because the container would tell you so. And then we'd also have cellular milk,
yeah.
which could be added to Twinkies and whatever else, Cheese Whiz or whatever products wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
The source of the milk.
Yeah, I agree. Caleb Harper from MIT just spoke and he shared a stat that really hit me and it really kind of encapsulates this allergy to science, is that I think he showed, don't quote me on the number, but it was something around how Congress, 80-some% of people in Congress approve labeling of food that has DNA. And I just take a step back and yeah. just really sink in, let that sink in yeah. and think, you know, how can you ever really look at the true merits, the pros and cons of something as new as cellular agriculture right. when you think that yeah. DNA is an additive, yeah. you know?
It's an interesting conversation. There's another line of argumentation that goes that, you know, people say they don't want chemicals in their food. Well, you know, chemistry is everything as well. Biochemistry is what food is. I mean, it's like it falls in the same thing. On the other hand, if you look at the history of food innovation, we've always had a lot of confidence in our beliefs about how complete our understanding of how it all works is. When they discovered vitamins, well, then vitamins is the only thing that mattered. And they said, well, we just put vitamins in the soil. We'll put
yeah.
vitamins in the food. We'll fortify the cereal with vitamins and it'll be
yeah.
all good. And now we're like, well, you know, that's not so great. And like, and we just discovered microbiome recently.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, all of this time we have been relying for our immune function on this feature of our own bodies that we had no idea how it worked. And now we're just beginning to understand how it works. So on the one hand, you don't want to be anti-science. You don't want to close your mind to those things. But on the other hand, I think we need humility in the face of the, yes. this development, because we've been so wrong and it's so complex.
Yes.
There's so many of the entrepreneurs, like the guy who does Soylent. This guy is so confident that he totally understands how food works, and he doesn't. Now he's got two products in the market that are making yeah. people vomit.
Yeah.
Well, guess what, dude? You don't know how food works.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we need to be, you know, we need a balanced options, and I like your attitude about yeah. letting consumers.
But it also comes back to just this idea of biodiversity. You know, again, Soylent's one where a lot of people have demonized because they say, "Is this the future of food?" Hell no. Well, again, like, I don't even think Soylent wants everyone in the world to be only right. having Soylent. Soylent was designed for a very specific use case, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a coder who's sitting there and doesn't want to ever get up, right?
Right.
And honestly, it's like sort of the evolution of the Slim Fast Milk yeah. cake in a sense. But, you know, look, in a world where we're all looking very diversely at food, mm-hmm. maybe you might have a Soylent when you're walking out of the gym and you have to run and grab something to eat. But is Soylent going to be your food of choice every single day? Like, maybe 0.00001% of the population mm-hmm. will do that.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's not. I don't think any of these things have a chance to become the majority of anyone's diet. And,
yeah.
well, maybe that's a hope.
Yeah. But, absolutely. All right. So last question. You think about food all day. You think about the future of food. You're up to your eyeballs in all these incredible ideas about what's happening in the world of food. What's your own diet like?
My own diet is pretty diverse. You know, lately I've been sort of on a grass-fed beef kick, just because, I was just in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
That really turned me on to there. But, I try to stay as diverse as possible because I think it's just new opportunities to learn. You know, living in New York City, it's really, it's hard not to want to participate in all the different beautiful ethnic cuisines. And I
yeah.
think I'm really, you know, tapping into that. So my diet is not really one thing, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of everything, and I kind of take the same approach to innovation, looking at diverse sources of inspiration. I look at food in the same way, and so mm-hmm. we always try to mix it up, whether we're eating at home or going out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's a brilliant future, and for people who, and I'm sure all the listeners are going to be really interested in following what you do, how can they do that? Where can they go to sort of sign up to receive additional information going forward from what
yeah,
you
Yeah, best way to keep in touch is to go to thefuturemarket.com and sign up for our newsletter.
Right.
We do a weekly newsletter that covers talking points on the future of food, and we also have announcements for new prototype products and new projects through there, so thefuturemarket.com.
Mike Lee, thank you so much for talking to me today here on the FatCast.
Thank you.
All right, thanks again.
View is a tiny four-person startup in San Francisco that's inventing a kind of smart glasses that don't have a screen, they don't have a camera. The main interface is a touch pad on the side and also a blinking light. You can also talk to your phone just as you would with a Bluetooth headset and use the glasses to have phone conversations and that sort of thing. I wrote about it for Computer World. You can check out the article on the computerworld.com website. I didn't mean to publish this interview. That wasn't my intent initially. I just recorded the interview, but I'm experimenting with taking some of the interviews and conversations that I have with sources and with companies and entrepreneurs and putting them into the FatCast because they're pretty interesting. It's a lot more information than you would normally get in an article. And you can see how startups and entrepreneurs, people in the industry, think about the products that are available in the technology space. So here's my behind-the-scenes conversation with View co-founder Tian Zhang and product marketing manager Aaron Rowley.
I understand that you can do prescription lenses, all that kind of stuff. How does that work? How did somebody has prescription glasses, how would they?
Yeah, so we're not handling it. We're not actually manufacturing the lenses, but we're partnering with a lens provider. So
okay.
we're going to have a tool basically in the same way that Kickstarter sends out like a survey to collect addresses.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to send out a survey that actually walks them through selecting the exact lens they
okay.
want, entering in their prescription. There's still a few things we'll figure out. I know some of the online glasses retailers
mm-hmm.
will actually allow you to like fax a prescription because not everyone can enter it
right.
correctly. So there's tiny logistics that we'll talk through. You know, maybe we have to do something like
uh-huh.
that. But for now, it will be like a web interface where people can enter their information in.
And you probably thought about a Warby Parker kind of thing where you do an online
right.
Fitting and all that. They have this crazy stuff where you use a credit card to...
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever gone through all that stuff.
Yeah, there's
pretty cool.
Yeah, there's some really cool options out there. There's also a few. I mean, we've also been contacted by some vendors that do like virtual sizing. I'm not sure how well those work, but
We definitely will try to offer this kind of like thing in the future, so people can try, because a lot of people care about like the style, which one I should choose, what color works better for me.
Right.
So we'll try to do something in the future to let our backers to try them online.
Okay.
Yeah, we want to, I think that's, it's like we're juggling so many things at once as like a 4-person team, but we're only offering 2 sizes.
Yeah.
So that is a concern. So we'll definitely, we're definitely listening to that already. And then, you know, depending on how funding goes, we might be able to branch out in sizing too to help.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, so I'm just throwing questions out there.
Yeah,
this is going to be all over the place.
That's right.
So obviously the global monopoly in glasses is Luxottica.
Yeah.
And there were rumors a year or two ago that they were working with Google Glass kind of a thing. There's all kinds of different companies at play, but a lot, you know, Luxottica is a lot of them. I'm going to be looking at the, what is it, the Oakley...
They just launched that one.
Bicyclists or whatever.
Right.
And you guys have gone... So first of all, is there a weird problem with dealing with in a space where one company is just completely dominates frames, for example? Is that
right? So
something you struggle with, or
not yet. I think a lot of it comes down to margins and finding factories. A lot of these places are very vertically integrated, so they're going to control everything from frame manufacturing all the way to lenses, and they can keep costs down. So there is a challenge there. Not one that we can't overcome, but I think scaling would probably be where the challenge is, finding a factory that can handle that volume, just because unless you're working for one of those global groups, I mean, it's very hard to find somebody who can handle high volume and high quality too.
Right.
And there's other restrictions, right? Like the factories have to be FDA compliant to import into the US.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's obviously a lot of quality standards that the factory has to meet and those big groups can help with. So.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't felt it yet, but like we know it's there for sure. But we've been fortunate enough to talk to quite a few lens partners, and so far, and it seems like very doable.
Yeah, and they even offer like us, we can sell our product through their website because they can see, even just put our own name, our product directly, because they can see this is a totally new market. This won't ruin their brand or take their market. They can see people even like purchase their product well. Buy our product.
Do you think that's going to be a major way that you sell? Is for example, somebody goes to the optometrist and they have these frames, and one of the options is smart frames. Is that going to be the major way that you sell these glasses, or is it going to be more direct, or what do you envision?
I mean, you can go ahead. I would think direct first, right?
Yeah, I think right now, based on the units volume we have right now, probably direct. But in the future, if we have a chance. Because, you know, like a lot of people, their insurance covers the cost of the frames, and we have some backers. Like, if the insurance can cover the cost, it would be awesome for them. So, definitely, there will be a direction, like, this is a direction that I would like to work on in the future.
Mm-hmm. And that actually is where a lot of regulatory burdens come into play. Like, I guess technically, we're going to be an out of network provider, and it's up to them to get it approved for coverage right now. So getting into like an optometry office and getting frames on the shelf in places is going to require a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I think short-term direct is probably where it makes sense.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that I think that would be awesome, right? To be able to go in and choose affordable smart frames. I mean, that would be, I think that's that would be the ideal.
Yeah, because actually it's my idea because I wear glasses every day.
Yeah.
It's the same thing for 20 years on my face. Like my watch, my everything else, they are smart right now.
Yeah.
But if you see the smart glasses in market right now, Google Glass is not for people like me who wear glasses every day.
Right.
I can't put them on face without getting a weird look like she's a dork.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, so I just want to do something like I put on my face, make my life more convenient, but it's not something really bulky and intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But and I think that in that vein, like, I still think we see Google Glass and a lot of these players as like the pioneers. And I think what we hope to do is, you know, get sort of a small basic platform and eventually look at how we can integrate some of those really cool things like AR and into the frames once the technology is slim enough, because I think that's definitely the future.
So right now you don't have a screen, you don't have a camera, and that's where the
baggage of Google Glass was, because then you need a visual operating system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like there's a lot of complexity. It's also the thing that made them look dorky. It's also the thing that made people uncomfortable with the camera. And so you've eliminated kind of a lot of the problems of Google Glass. You've also eliminated some of the functionality, because you don't see a screen, you don't see the pictures, you don't see the picture of the person who's calling you, you know, little stuff like that.
Yeah. Exactly.
But you have lights that sort of blink in the inside, right?
So here is a small LED light that give you notification once there is an incoming call or message. You can get like lights notification here.
And is that something that just out of the box works, or do you have to go in a program, say green means Steve is calling and red means whatever, or is there any sort of customization that, or user customization?
Yeah, we definitely want to offer them like very like highly customization in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that'll be an app. Work.
Yep.
Yeah, we have an app.
Yeah. I don't know if you have any of the demos, apps, but
And the bone conduction audio is in one side or two sides?
Two sides.
So these two pads are the speakers here.
And you have batteries on both sides?
Battery in one side, PCB in the other.
Okay, great. I think it was like 3 years ago or something, two, three years ago. I wrote a column and said, man, Google should just get rid of the camera. It would be so much better without the camera.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I said get rid of the screen, but I think I said get rid of the camera.
Right.
And it's like, biggest differentiator is you can't tell they're smart glasses.
Right.
Yeah.
Like nobody can tell.
Yeah.
Except this thing is whispering in your ear and like not your ear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the blinking and stuff like that. Yeah. And I actually think that's the future of smart stuff. Like, I think that, you know, in 5 years, a lot of people will have their phone and internet connectivity and a watch, and then they'll have glasses, and there's no phone. And it's like, you know, you walk around, you're taking calls, you're talking to something like Google Assistant or Siri or something like that, and it's all through that kind of interface.
Right.
And so I really think you're on something. But is there another company that you're aware of that's doing this, that has glasses that are just undetectable?
So yeah, it's interesting. There's definitely some out there. I don't think anyone's on the market. So there's LaForge. They actually have pre-orders, and their thing is AR. They're a little bit more, I don't know the right word, like high fashion, I think, in terms of their aesthetic, but they do look very slim and nice, and their thing is AR. I don't know when they're shipping or when that's slated to happen. And then there's another one called Level. They're out of a lab. They're like a collaboration between USC and a big global eyeglass provider.
Yeah.
And they're focused primarily on fitness tracking and other health metrics. And they're also, they're just doing a pilot study, and the results of the pilot study come out in 2017. So I don't know when they're launching.
Yeah.
So as far as we know, you know, so far with this, we stand to be the first ones actually on the market, but people are definitely looking to get these kind of products out there.
Okay. And you had mentioned you would be thinking in the future about some kind of augmented reality or mixed reality kind of thing. What would you use to present the visual, or would you use visuals?
I mean, that's like really far future.
Have you seen a Carl Zeiss?
Yeah, things? Carl Zeiss is one of them. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I haven't tried it, but read a lot about it.
I don't think anybody has. I mean, it's like, I can't get anything out of these guys.
Yeah. So we actually worked, did you know the Korean? So we worked in an accelerator in China. Won't go too much into it.
The glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something super similar where it was embedded in the lens actually with that grating. I never got to try that one either, but.
I tried it. Oh,
okay.
I just put it down.
Yeah. So it seems really cool. I mean, I think the honest answer is we don't quite know yet.
Yeah, because I think so for our product, most important thing is make it look normal.
Yeah.
So as long as the technology is slim enough to build into the glasses, we're fine, we're open to it. But if it changes the design of the product, then we will rethink about it.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can use this with whatever the audio is on your phone, right? So it could be Google Assistant, Siri, whatever phone you have.
Yeah. And there's a little microphone up here too, so you can, it will pick a voice. Yeah.
I imagine that's a tricky thing. Do you have any crazy technology in that, or is that essentially a smartphone microphone?
Yeah, I mean, so with the Bluetooth headset, that's what the experience in that is kind of nice, because a lot of that kind of core functionality translates really nicely to this in terms of microphone, Bluetooth, and the audio, and actually even the LED. So there's a lot of crossover there. So it's like a noise canceling high quality microphone that you would find in like a Bluetooth headset.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And how's your Kickstarter going? You met your goal right away, right?
Yeah. Just hit our 300K today in a week, which is
great.
Wow, think was it a week? Yeah.
Yeah, we launched last Tuesday. Yeah, mm-hmm. Today's Wednesday.
Yeah,
so
we're
so
at
away.
303 right now. 37 is my little dashboard.
Yeah.
I'm like refreshing it every second.
What was your goal?
50,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
But our real goal is like around 500K mm-hmm. to real like to make it break even in terms of like manufacturing
mm-hmm.
and hire some experts to help us to make the product looks better.
Yeah.
Every and like handling all the shipping everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what do you think the demand is for these? I know you're a small company and probably don't have a lot of time to do market research, but
yeah. It's hard to say. I think there's bigger demand than people think.
Yeah, because actually before we like launched Kickstarter, so my background design, so I actually the small group like in San Francisco do some like research. We invite people come here to talk about this and because it's a whole new product,
mm-hmm.
so when you explain it to people, it's very hard for them to imagine how could this fit to their everyday life
mm-hmm.
without you give them an actual pair of glasses to let them see and try on.
Mm-hmm.
So at that moment, it was not very clear, but once we launched, like even right now, we haven't got a chance to talk to a lot of media outlets, which because we're kind of busy to work on this prototype, but still we can see a very stable sales from Kickstarter every day. Instead
mm-hmm.
of like, you know, some company, they went really well for their first 2 days and the sales went down directly for only few thousand dollars every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have very stable sales.
Yeah, that's the nice thing. It's like the general trend is big incoming funds in the first 2 days and it drops down very low, but we've actually had a pretty
mm-hmm.
solid daily. I mean, of course the question is, does that translate after Kickstarter into real sales,
right?
Yeah.
Not just the crowdfunding hype. So we'll see. I think there is a bigger market. I mean, we've talked to a lot of glasses providers, actually a lot of optometrists too that have contacted us. So I think it's there, but you know, you're right, we're a small team, it's hard to fully gauge that quite yet.
Yep.
But we feel like confident enough to go for it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, you know, my guess is people, you know, most of the people who would want this don't know they want it yet.
Right.
Because it's not on people's radar. If they think about smart glasses at all, they think about Google Glass and like, no way.
Yeah.
And then they think about wearables, they think about watches, and they think, well, it's kind of, you know, problematic and expensive,
right.
And do I really want that? And I don't think this kind of product is on anybody's radar, except for the techno, you know, the seriously...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Geeky, like
yeah.
gadget
totally.
Freaks, but.
Yeah, actually, it's one thing that is a little bit challenging for us to do marketing because,
yeah.
well, we probably to call ourselves smart glasses, but we are very different than most of the other smart glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if you call yourself a pair of glasses, it's not smart
mm-hmm.
enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's kind
that's
of
something
trying
to
find that balance, yeah.
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 But. Can I take a look at your app? Do you have
yeah, we have.
We have a mock-up.
And we got like the old one that's very ugly, and now we're just starting to get the mock-ups in. But
yeah,
like our activity tracking section was basically just the raw data on the screen.
This is the old one. I can bring my laptop and show the
design. Okay.
Yeah. So
this is the first iteration.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So this
is the first iteration.
Actually, I don't know if this is the functional one. So there's some of the activity tracking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this might be the really old one. Yeah. She'll grab the new one. Here's some of the mock-ups of it, looking for view.
That's a new.
I didn't know if this was the actual updated one, though.
Yeah, that's a new one. Yeah, so that's like finding my glasses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, okay, you're right. That's right. I did read about that.
Yeah.
So
we'll
and
have...
here you can see your activity. Like your daily data, like your steps, distance, and calories.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the other?
This is not.
Yeah, so
finishing.
It's not fully functional. This
yeah.
is mostly just the mock-up part.
Sure, but what you're aiming for is what you just explained, the finding the glasses, the sort of fitness stuff. Is there any customization or tailoring,
yeah.
like the light, for example?
That's one thing I want to show. It's the notification part.
Mm-hmm.
It's like where you can customize how you want to get the incoming call, the light, like you just mentioned, mm-hmm. or how do you want to?
Yeah, so we'll have different options here.
Like long price, double.
Yeah, so depending on the way you interact with the glasses, if you use two-finger tap or one tap, you can mm-hmm. have it dictate, let's say, the weather, report, like, how many calories you burn that day. Mm-hmm. It could be answer a call. It could be ignore a call.
Right.
I think we have four gestures right now. Single tap, double tap, swipe, and then the long press. And those will be how people interact with it.
So you can user specify what happens?
Right.
And is there a default, like out of the box, if people don't specify anything, it will just like one tap will be answer the call,
yeah,
whatever it is?
Yeah, exactly. Same with the LED notifications, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But if somebody, you know, prefers a yellow light for a missed call instead of a red, you mm-hmm. know, they can yeah. alter that. Yeah.
What about charging?
So that's it's interesting. When we chose to do contact charging
mm-hmm.
Right here.
Yeah, the popping thing. So the glasses case itself is a charging case.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use a case to charge your glasses
yeah.
automatically every day. Like once you finish using, put it back, you will charge mm-hmm. directly through the case. And with the case, hopefully it can last for a whole week without charging it.
Really?
Charging extra.
Yeah. So it will be about 2 to 3 days in standby, so like activity tracking, notification forwarding, and then
yeah.
if you're streaming continuous audio, it's about 5 to 6 hours.
Okay.
And then we chose not to put any ports on there just because that also affected size.
Mm-hmm.
So you will have to use the case, yeah.
And so it charges with the glasses inside the case?
Right. You just plot. I don't know if we have the prototype here.
And then and then the case has to be plugged in for the charging to be happening, right? You can't just charge the case.
You can do that.
You can. And then you can carry it around while the glasses
exactly.
are charging.
Right.
Wow,
yeah.
that's
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
yeah.
So the actually similar product is the Braggy's Dash.
Yeah. Or okay. like the new iPhone, the AirPod, like
yeah.
the case itself is a charging case.
Yes. So it's like that.
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
Like that.
And so the idea is that basically if you fully charge the case and you bring it with you on the go,
yeah.
you'll get the equivalent of a week's worth of charge out of that for
right.
the glasses.
And if you charge both the glasses fully and the case fully and you take it with you and then the glass can run out, you put it in
yeah.
and it charges
right.
even if you're not near an outlet.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we know that battery life is a question like people care about.
Yeah.
Like even myself, when I get my Apple Watch, the reason
mm-hmm.
I give up using it because I need to charge it every day, which
yeah,
is not something I really can do. So
yeah.
I know, like, for a pair of glasses, at least the standby time to be 2 to 3 days because it's something we will use
mm-hmm.
every day.
Mm-hmm.
So we are trying to work on really hard in terms of the battery. Like,
yeah.
Something
we're excited about too is retention, though, because I mean, so I had through 2 Fitbits
yeah.
and I stopped using them both times because I just like forgot to put them on.
Yeah.
But I think we're curious to see what ends up happening because, you know, with glasses, especially for corrective needs, it's a different story. And so people will put them on every day.
Right.
And they won't leave the house and leave it on the charger. So I think that's, and there's a little bit, we hope, of like intuitiveness to
mm-hmm.
the fact that people put them back in their cases and
right.
still kind of a hypothesis. But I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I always thought smart glasses were going to be the dominant wearable at some point because, you know, like you say, even if you don't feel like using a smart device, you're still going to need to see.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're going to
yeah.
wear your glasses. And
yeah.
You're going to bring them, and you know, you already have the habit of
yeah.
having glasses and wearing them and stuff. So it's kind of like, I guess, sticky would be the.
Yeah. Right.
the word.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I actually wore, the reason I was interested in the product was because I sometimes wear glasses for style purposes, but
mm-hmm.
we'll see if that added features. I don't wear them often enough, but we'll see if that
yeah.
keeps you wearing them,
yeah.
other than you who
yeah.
needs this.
But yeah, but also people wear sunglasses.
Right.
Yeah.
yeah. So everyone has a pair of glasses, just
right.
different.
Yeah,
yeah,
right. Yeah.
Very cool.
And these are actually these are the real polarized lens,
yeah,
right?
These
yeah.
Are
yeah.
The
yeah.
polarized
nice.
Lenses.
So what else should I know? Your glasses, your company.
Trying to think. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Any advice for our product? Like, we'd like.
Seems
to
like you're. Seems like you're on the right track. I really like the. I really like the simplicity of it, and I think that the having them not be obvious. Smart glasses is the secret.
Yeah,
I really think that's
definitely hope so. I mean, I think that's something a lot. I think that's the nice thing is to see that reaffirmed, even just in some comments that we've had. Of course, it might be confirmation bias, but just people saying like, oh great, like, you know, this looks like what I've been waiting for. So yeah, I think that's the gamble, I think, with us compared to some of the other smart glasses groups, is that actually TechCrunch posted an article and ended on a really interesting comment, like just speaking frankly, which was like, is part of having a wearable the fact that people can see it's a wearable? Like, is there some part of it that people want to be wearing something new and techy? And I don't know, but it's something I never really thought about. But
yeah, the answer is no. And yeah. And there's a lot of bias in the tech and the tech journalism community that's
right.
just this sort of insular world where they think, well, if I like it, it will succeed in the market, which
right.
isn't true. And it's tech journalists and a few people who are kind of like tech journalists like to walk around and say, hey, I have the new snap glasses,
yeah,
or whatever, look at me,
yeah.
But like, you know, there's such a tiny minority.
True.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
The public just doesn't want to be walking around with some conspicuous thing.
Yeah,
you
right
know?
Yeah,
I'm certain of it. And
yeah.
So yeah, I would ignore that that little note. I think they're completely wrong about that. You know, this is one of the reasons why everybody got excited in the early days of smartwatches when you know you could actually get a round watch because it looked like a regular watch.
Totally,
it was,
yeah.
Was it the Moto 360 or whatever
yeah,
it was?
Yeah, right.
He's like, oh my god, I was at Google I/O when they rolled that out, and he's like, oh my god, that's so great! It looks like a regular watch.
Yeah, that's funny
you know?
Say that because that was totally my impression of it too.
Yeah.
Like that design still sticks out in my head.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
It failed in the market, but
yeah.
but that was one of the key benefits, is that you could pass
yeah.
as a regular person with a normal watch
right.
yeah.
if you wanted to.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. This is great.
Cool.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure.
Oh, by the way, so one more question
yeah.
for me. So based on experience, who do you think will be our like early adopter for this pair of glasses? Do you have any like thoughts?
You know, it's funny because really, what's happening, one of the most interesting things happening in technology is what you might call hearables. So
mm-hmm.
Braggy Dash, as you mentioned,
yeah.
and to a kind of certain extent, the Apple AirPods are that transition to go from like to go from just dumb audio port
yeah.
Headphones wired for Apple to do this, to go to these little, there's computers in each one. You know,
yeah.
there's AI actually yeah. that's figuring out, I removed one, so kick the other one over to
yeah.
mono and stuff. It's typical Apple to use really advanced technology for tiny little usability features.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that everything that, like the virtual assistants are about to get AI.
Yeah.
And so that's going to drive the need for people to always have something whispering in their ear all day.
Yeah,
and be able
yeah.
to talk, just talk. And right now everybody loves Amazon Echo because you just talk, right? You don't
right.
you don't open something and start an app. It's whether you just talk to the room, and the room talks back, and you're interacting with the internet just
yeah.
naturally. So this is what you're going to get either through hearables or through this product. Nobody knows it yet, but there's, you know, in a couple of years, everybody's going to be interacting with computers by just talking.
Yeah.
And so this is a great form factor for that world that, you know, that it's going to be with us forever. AI virtual assistants is the last user interface because it's the one that's perfect for human nature.
Yeah.
We're designed and hardwired to talk through speech to other people, and that's how we want to interact with computers, just
yeah.
like Star Trek.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing is to have microphones everywhere and have Amazon Echoes and Google Homes everywhere, but the other one is have it on you.
Right.
And then it's always everywhere,
yeah.
right? And then you have a device, which could be a phone, but it could also be a watch. It could be eventually just the glasses by themselves. But that's your competition. You're competing with hearables.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
And also the other companies that sort of get the notion of having smart glasses that don't look like smart glasses. But
yeah.
that's the world we're in. It's like the killer app is virtual assistant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're about to get crazy good like
yeah.
in the next few years. Right now Siri's dumb and like Google Now is like a pain in the neck and stuff like that. But Google Assistant will grow into something amazing. And Siri is getting serious AI
yeah.
coming up soon. And Viv, which is going to be Samsung's, I think, you know, it was a mistake for them to go with Samsung, but that's another Google Assistant-like virtual assistant. And so AI is going to make everybody want these.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's super exciting to think about.
Yeah.
And I would really, you know, I would really emphasize that, because I personally have experienced a thrill of just having like just regular Bluetooth. I have these waterproof Bluetooth headphones that I wear all the time. And just to, depending on what you do with your phone and your notifications and stuff like that, you just like being guided all day by this voice in your head, essentially.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
really quite an amazing thing. Nobody else can hear it.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think that's a killer.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Like the movie Her.
Like the movie
Her,
except,
right?
You know. And
wearable computers.
Yeah, yeah. And people will fall in love with their virtual assistants.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Subscribe to the Fatcast at fatcast.audio and share it with your friends. Click on the iTunes link to rate and review this podcast. I'd love the feedback. My name is Mike Elgin. There goes the Fatcast.